You're listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan, broadcasting from WPKN Bridgeport and WPKM Montauk. Today we're talking about dark tourism, what it is, how many flavors it comes in, and whether it's a good or a bad thing. It seems that we humans are hardwired to leave our hearths and homes every now and then to discover what else lies beyond the horizon. So we turn into tourists or travelers, timid or intrepid, hewing to the known or smitten by the uncharted, more or less conscious of what we are seeing as we go. Perhaps the repetitive pressure of much contemporary life has stimulated our appetites for the authentic and the spectacular, allowing the emergence of a new genre, dark tourism and the dark tourist, motivated by death and disaster and apocalypse, rather than by sun and sea and sand and pastoral living, with even ecotourism and adventure travel no longer stimulating enough. Amanda Kendall is a travel writer for Vagabondish, an online travel magazine. She also writes on her own blog, Not a Ballerina. Reading her articles was the first time I'd heard of dark tourism, so I called her in Perth, Western Australia, and asked her to explain what this is all about.
Dark tourism is a phrase that's recently come into the industry, I guess. The first time I heard about it was maybe only last year in Lonely Planet. Some Blue List came up with a darkometer, a kind of a scale of dark tourism. And dark tourism is broadly something that's a tourist may or may not be doing the right thing by visiting such a place or carrying out some kind of tourism. But let me give you an overview of the different kinds of dark tourism. I guess the most common one, it's something we often do, but you may not realize it's dark tourism, is something called grief tourism. Visiting the scene of some tragic event or visiting a cemetery or a war memorial even is a kind of grief tourism. There's a scale it gets to the kind of tourism that I really don't like. For example, in Paris, where you could do a Princess Diana tour and travel down the tunnel where she was in the car accident which killed her. And that's also a kind of grief tourism. Another kind of dark tourism is disaster tourism, which is also controversial. For example, visiting New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina or visiting Asia after the tsunami, whether you visit to help or whether you visit later just to see what happened, to see the aftermath of the disaster, it's another kind of dark tourism. And then, like you mentioned, Hazel, poverty tourism is definitely, in my mind, quite a dark tourism. If you go somewhere explicitly to see how the poor people live, to go into the slums of a large city, I guess the worst case scenario is you hear of tours where a bunch of tourists go in a beautiful, comfortable, air-conditioned bus and they drive around the slums and take pictures out the window. Just one more that's quite interesting to me is the a new term is doomsday tourism, which kind of ties in a little bit with the ecotourism. The doomsday tourists want to visit a place before it's gone. So, for example, to visit the Arctic or the Antarctic before it melts, if you think that global warming will take these places away. Here in Australia, sometimes you hear that the Great Barrier Reef is being destroyed through global warming, and so people are rushing to see it. While it's still beautiful, while it's still there. So that's the doomsday tourism idea.
So how does that contrast with, I guess, more conventional tourism? You go to a beach or you go to a mountain or you see something beautiful. What is the difference, under the sort of essential difference here, do you think?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I can't even work it out myself in a way. It's like if you're driving down a highway and you see a car accident, and it's that natural human instinct to have a look. even though maybe you don't want to see a dead body or you don't really want to see a car wreck, but somehow you're morbidly fascinated by seeing it. And I guess it's part of that interest that makes people want to see some of these places. And sometimes it's not so bad as that. It's maybe an interest in seeing bad things that have happened in the past, so to learn about them, you know, to learn from history. Like, for example, to visit the concentration camps in Europe. That's something I've done quite well, several times, and it's very disturbing, but I feel like it was worth visiting because I learned a lot. So I guess compared to lying on a beach, it's either an instinct to want to see something bad or an instinct to want to learn about something bad that happened, rather than just relax on your holiday, which is also okay.
Some varieties of dark tourism focus on people, others on places. Some focus on man-made, some on natural cataclysms. Some are about living people, others about historical or recently dead people. Ecotourism is very much about the living, defined by the Ecotourism Society as responsible travel to natural areas which conserves the environment and improves the welfare of the local people. Although ecotourism does not, on the face of it, qualify as dark tourism, I propose that some of its consequences could be very dark indeed. 10 or so years ago, I was an ecotourist. How noble and green and enlightened and adventurous of me, I thought, traveling to Ecuador's rainforest and the Amazon to see nature under attack, so that when I returned to New York City, I could report on the fragility of it all, on the poverty, but also on the wisdom of the jungle people. I would become an advocate, and I would persuade others to go see for themselves, and the world would then be a better place. Wrong! Do not go, is what I would say now. Keep your feet and your footprints right here at home. Look at photographs others have brought back and listen to their stories. Support the efforts of the rainforest custodians or the Galapagos or the Alaskan wilderness by donating money, but don't add your presence and the carbon footprints it will take to get there. Leave yourself at home. Let the native people and the flora and fauna be. It's the enlightened thing to do. But this is now, and I'm talking about then. Then I joined a dozen or so other people on a trip offered by a New Age organization in New York City. It was the first group trip I had ever signed on for, and so far it has also been my last. A well-known leader was going to lead us into the rainforest, where we would stay with indigenous people, visit shamans, learn about the healing powers of plants and trees, do psychonavigation, drumming, and shape-shifting, and, an implicit promise not verbalized in the brochure, we'd be able to sample the ayahuasca drug in a country where the long arm of U.S. law could never reach us. Here's what my diary pages have to tell about one of my days as an eco-tourist. We walked about 4 hours, ending up at the house of a shaman in a clearing by the river. The people were making a hammock out of palm trees and making yarn from the young leaves. It was very hot, no noonday covering. We sat around, I drained my canteen, and then some of our New Agenics went shopping. To my chagrin and deep shame, they bought the hammock, the stools, and anything else that was movable. One woman walked around in her bra, another took off her jeans as if they were in a Sheraton resort. The Indians, evangelized by the missionaries, are a very modest, prim people. I discussed my feelings with one of the women, trying to make sense out of the fact that we were supposed to be on a spiritual journey, to learn from the Indians, and instead here we were, raping their homes, escalating their sense of materialism, shopping their homes, for God's sake. The jungle mall. Nobody was interested in learning how they use certain parts of the palm tree for the hammock and others for brooms or baskets. The rush to buy continued when we went to another house to see their pottery and then went on unrestrained at the back of the settlement where we slept. Eventually, the shaman intervened, as what was left of headdresses, bowls, baskets, stools were being traded for sleeping bags, money, mosquito repellent, flashlight, watches, and money. If you were to ask D, our Ecuadorian leader, why he encourages this crass behavior from his group, he would say he's trying to show them that ecotourism is profitable and also they really need the money. He's on their side and doesn't really care what we do or how we demean ourselves. That interests me is, what are the ethics of offering misfortune as a commodity for sale, of paying to see poverty, of objectifying slum dwellers and street children, not necessarily with an intent of remedying their condition? Is paying to see glue-sniffing street kids in the slums of Delhi any different from paying to see animals in the zoo? Is the otherness of the animals different from the otherness of the children? If you were such a child, would you have any way of understanding why Western tourists come to look at you, snapping pictures and talking to each other about you? Surely there's something slightly perverse in spending vacation time observing profound misery. I asked Amanda Kendall to tell me some more about specific places that draw poverty tourists.
I know of especially three particular places where poverty tourism is I don't know, well promoted, let's say. Or, for example, in South Africa, around Johannesburg, there's quite a lot of tours that you can take to the townships around Soweto. And I think they vary. Sometimes they're the air-conditioned buses because it's supposed to be relatively dangerous. So perhaps the well-to-do tourists want to see it, but not too close. Similarly, in Mumbai, in India, it's becoming quite famous to take a poverty tour through this kind of the squatter settlements around Mumbai. Some of which sound maybe more in inverted commas, acceptable to me because they're trying to get people, they want the tourists to see that the people there are making progress and are helping themselves. So they take them, for example, to a community center where people are, I don't know, creating crafts or something to sell. So they're trying to help themselves out of poverty. And also perhaps the most famous is in Rio de Janeiro, two of the favelas. Apparently that's been going on for about 20 years, taking tourists around to these kind of shanty towns around Rio. And I think from what I can gather, some do it well and some do it kind of really voyeuristically and not so well. So.
You mean the tour operators or the tourists?
Both, but the tour operators in particular, I guess, influence that the most.
What kind of thing do you mean when you say they do it voyeuristically?
I mean, this is the kind of the air-conditioned bus thing where you just drive through and you're very safe and happy in your comfortable surroundings, but you can see the people outside, so who are perhaps living in extreme poverty or in terrible living conditions. And you're just gawking, I suppose. I mean, to me, that's not an interesting thing to do, but apparently some people do like to do that. Maybe they have an interest in seeing how the other half live, but they don't want to get too close.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. What do you think they get out of it? I mean, after having been on, say, a favela tour or something like that, what do you think what stays in their minds?
Because I think differently, I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that these people want to go home and say to their friends, "Oh, I saw these poor people in Brazil," and it's almost a little bit of a status point to say, you know, I've seen really how the poor people live. Perhaps sometimes they want to help them, they want to send some donations or something. Perhaps they then can look around their own beautiful home and think, "Oh, how lucky I am," or I'm not sure exactly what the motivation of everybody is. So.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it's sort of a bit akin to adventure travel. You know, it's like going down the Amazon or something, and you're thinking, you know, I've really been to the edge or something like that.
Yeah, I have a feeling that for some people it's like that. It's a bit of a badge of honor to say, "Oh, I was in this dangerous place, and look, I survived, and here I am, and here's the pictures."
Because, I mean, you know, let's talk about really what the issues are that all of this raises. I mean, if you go to India anyway, say you're going to Mumbai or you're going to Delhi or something, and you inevitably see poverty. I mean, it's everywhere you look in the
Sure.
subcontinent, India, Pakistan, anywhere like that. So
Yeah.
is but there's something different about this particular, calling it tourism. I mean, calling it poverty tourism because one is going intentionally, just for that purpose, rather than that you sort of see it as you pass by.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. If you're staying somewhere in India, you will be walking past poor, you know, extremely poor people every day. That's just part of what you'll see. But actually signing up and paying money to someone to take you to an especially poor part is a really intentional step to take. So it depends, I guess, on your motivation and on the motivation of the tour guide. And I think it also depends on, I mean, this is also, it's involving money. It depends where the money's going. For example, some of the tour operators make sure that the money raised from those tours is really invested into those local communities. Whereas I'm sure there's some who just like making a profit out of it. So it's a really, it's a kind of a continuum of bad to good, and it's hard to know
A
for in each
continuum of what?
situation, which is
I'm sorry, say that
a
again.
continuum. It's kind of a continuum of bad to good,
Oh,
and
bad to good, yeah.
yeah, and I don't know. Yeah, each tour and each tourist perhaps lies somewhere on that line, and it's hard to know when it's okay and when it's not.
Yeah, because one of the issues also that it seems to me is, for instance, in ecotourism, one of the things is that you're trying to protect the very thing that you're visiting. So don't tread to, you know, the idea is go and see it, then you'll respect it and you'll have, you know, admiration for it, and then you will, I don't know, protect it in some other way. I don't know, give money, you know, live more lightly, I don't know. But the fact is that just by going there, you are in fact endangering the rainforest. The rainforest is best if it's left alone, not if it's sort of crawling with tourists, however good their intentions are. So it seems to me you are doing the very thing that you're trying not to do with ecotourism.
Absolutely, I agree with you,
But what about poverty tourism? I mean, now, as long as poverty exists, these tour operators have a business. So
That's what I always think, that it's actually the tour operators who are putting money back into the community are actually in a way shooting themselves in the foot,
yeah.
because if enough tourists come and help them out, then the poverty won't be there, and then they won't have a tour to operate anymore. But I guess the ones who are really doing it from the heart, then that's actually really is their goal. But I'm sure there's plenty who think that in a business-like way, we don't actually want to erase this poverty, or we'll have nothing to show the tourists anymore. So.
But would you recommend poverty, you know, people to go on these poverty tours?
Ah, that's a really tough question. As a general, as if I had to give a quick answer, I'd say no. However, if you've really researched the tour, maybe if you've talked to the organisers first, and you can see that it's something that is really helping the community, then maybe yes.
It's not like that at all, says Chris Way, owner with his partner Krishna Pujari of Reality Tours and Travel in Mumbai. They offer what they call slum tours of Dharavi, reportedly the largest slum in Asia, and they see it quite differently.
I, along with my Indian business partner, we run a tour and travel company in Colabo in South Mumbai. The main thing we do is we take tourists, mainly foreign tourists, around a place called Dharavi, which is reportedly Asia's biggest slum. The idea of the tour is to show a different side of the city. 55% of the people in the city live in slums. So I think to understand the city, then you need to arguably understand where the majority of the people live. So that's what we do. We take people and we show them around the area. Now, one of the key objectives is to sort of to break down this negative image that a lot of people have about Dharavi and about slums in general, that, you know, people are sitting around doing nothing, whereas in fact they are sort of hardworking. And this area in particular, there are a lot of sort of small-scale industries, so we highlight these small-scale industries on our tour. So the area is a fascinating place, and we try and show that to people in a sensitive way. I mean, we are very conscious about not upsetting the residents, respecting them. So we have a no camera policy. We operate tours in very small numbers, maximum group size is 6. And we do then put money back. So we have a community centre in the area where we operate English classes and computer classes, because when we ask the people, you know, what do you want us to do? That's what they said. They said they want, they want these things. So we provide those services. And also we have when we do make a profit, which we haven't done yet, then 80% of the profits will go back to NGOs, to charities in the area. And we don't have any issue with the people in the area. The main people we have issue with are the people who don't live in Dharavi, who say that, there are some people who say, oh, this is voyeuristic, without perhaps really knowing what's going on. I think they wonder why, you know, they're curious, why do these people want to see what we do? They do ask that question, and initially, yeah, of course they were curious, and so they asked us, and the tour guides would then explain. The people that go on the tour, we get feedback in the form of questionnaires. A lot of them say it's a very humbling experience, seeing people with relatively nothing and they are yet so productive and this strong sense of community. Because the area is, you know, it does have a very negative image. The fact that people do come in and they take interest in these people and they sort of ask them questions, there is some kind of interaction, albeit very basic. I think they like the fact, well, I know they like the fact that, you know, people are taking an interest in what they do, as opposed to thinking, oh, we're just slum dwellers, no one cares about us. There are people that are generally interested in what they're doing.
So would you choose another name for the way the industry refers to you?
Yeah, I think poverty tourism is a bit of a loaded term, but then, you know, slum tourism maybe, I like to think the name of our company is maybe a little bit more apt, reality tourism. I think a lot of the time the stories in the press have loaded arguments, you know, they have a particular angle and poverty tourism perhaps suits that angle. But I mean, it's the same on our tours. The people that don't know about what we do are not fully informed.
It's a complex subject, And altruism and greater good or not, it raises many provocative questions about voyeurism and exploitation. Perhaps it all boils down to intention. If you pay to go on a slum tour, what is it that you expect to see and why? Will you be disappointed and feel you didn't get your money's worth if the slum dwellers are not as desperate or hungry or poor or dysfunctional as you'd expected? Do you wonder if the glue-sniffing children in the Brazilian favelas were instructed to play up their glue-sniffing when the tourists come around? Do you wonder what would happen to the tourism business if poverty were eradicated one fine day? Dark questions, appropriate for dark tourism. For the peripatetic Amanda Kendall, there are still other ways of looking at it.
What I would like to do is to talk to some of the people who are the object of these tours, some of the people who are living in poverty. I don't know what their opinion is. No journalist reports on what they really think about this. For example, if I can try and imagine being in that situation and having people come by and take my photograph because I'm poor, oh, I can't think of anything worse. I'd be ashamed and embarrassed. But I don't know, maybe they see the economic potential of getting some more money coming into their community and maybe it's okay. So it's a really difficult question. But maybe if I compare to like some forms of grief tourism, for example, the other kind of dark tourism, there was this case in England a few years ago where two young girls were murdered in a small village. And after that, hundreds and hundreds of British people came to visit the village. There's nothing else to see there other than basically a memorial with a lot of flowers in honour of these two children. And they interviewed the locals there and they were horrified that people would come there and take photographs of their misery. So, I mean, if that translates to poverty areas, then if the people there don't want people coming to take pictures of them and to see them, then I think it's definitely not a good thing. But it's a complicated issue.
It is. So somehow that's overstepping the mark in a way to actually go there to, I guess it's gawking, the word gawking, as opposed to something else. I don't know what the other verb would be. But when it becomes gawking, then it seems to somehow have crossed the line.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the intentional nature of it. If you're in a country anyway, you're going about your normal traveling day and you see people in poverty, that's okay, that's normal. But if you're really intentionally wanting to see them, you want to take pictures and it's, like you say, gawking, for me that crosses the line.
Perhaps that is where we draw the bright line, at intention and consciousness. And nobody knows your intention better than you. Perhaps paradoxically, dark tourism contains its own light, the light of enlightenment. Know thyself and understand what it is that draws you to the dark side. And once there, understand what your actions may lead to. Whether you're being perverse, morbid, or a seeker of truth and knowledge, it's all okay when consciousness makes it so. Been listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan, broadcasting from WPKN Bridgeport and WPKM Montauk. Tidings can be heard on the first Thursday of every month at noon. Tidings from Hazel Khan is produced for WPKN by Tony Ernst.